Now let's start with some review. Remember just a real quick tour from the first class. We talked about Aquinas' life, how he is really an exemplar of Christian psychology, and how this material as a product of his unconscious is not only relevant to him, but it's relevant to us. And then we talked about Sophia conceptually, basically this idea of there being two dimensions, and Sophia being the a priori story in your life in that other dimension. I give you an interesting, I think I've got it here, an interesting interesting quote on this, another way just to look at this a priori identity, comes from Lawrence Vanderpost. You know Lawrence Vanderpost? Mm-hmm. His book, A Testament to the Bushman. He's talking about Jung here. He says, Jung told me how his work as a healer did not take wing, the metaphor is mine, until he realized that the key to the human personality was its story. Every human being, at core, he held, had a unique story, and no person could discover his or her greatest meaning unless he or she lived and, as it were, grew their own story. Should the person lose his story or fail to live it, the person lost meaning, became disoriented, the collective fodder of tyrants and despots, or ended up, as so many did, alienated and out of their minds, as had the patients in the Burke-Hosley Asylum to whom he owed this insight. So there you just get it in another language, that we each have our core. I'm reading from Testament to the Bushman. Not in the book. So that gives you an idea. Each person has their own story at core, and if we don't live it, then we fall afoul of ourselves. So that was Sophia and thoughts. Then we talked about some Sophia dreams. One of the key images, which you can remember from by looking at the cover of the study guide, is starlight. Another strange image of it would be the board game. Those are the two levels. A classic representation would be the dual mandala. Again, two dimensions. Last week, we just briefly touched on a very important image. I didn't want to overload you too much, but we'll come back to this as time permits. The image of DNA. DNA. If there is a inherited physical structure, there's also an inherited psychological structure. Some of the other images that we talked about were the idea of there being two levels to experience, and that dream where the child was known before it was born. And then the image of Mama Christ. Usually the dreams speak obliquely, but sometimes they speak very directly, as in the dream of Mama Christ. So that was dreams.
Question. As I recall, I think most of the dreams you presented were women's, except the Mama Christ one.
And my dream.
Okay. Is that Mama Christ dream usually something that appears in a man's dream as opposed to a woman?
Hmm.
Okay.
I don't think it makes any difference.
Okay.
Yeah, the reason I present more women is because I have more women in my practice.
Okay. Well, I wanted to clarify whether Sophia presents herself as personified as a woman or in these other...
No.
That
no.
Varies with
yeah.
Just a quick comment about
yeah.
that, because I just finished a paper on the Middle Ages, and what they talk about there is what they call a reversal. And they say in the liminal period, a man goes into reversal, which means he sees himself in the opposite structure. So there's very frequently they see themselves as women. And they men have more images of a mother god than women do.
Mm-hmm.
Women don't, because they're not the superior. They're the inferior. And so they don't then elevate themselves to the superior and see themselves. So when they see themselves as women, as the mother god, they're seeing themselves as themselves.
So it's sort of a direct sort of.
Yeah, have a sort of continuity male breach in order to be in that state.
Okay.
So there's more men that think about that. It's all, it has to do with the structure that we lived mm-hmm. in back then, which was so bereft of the feminine mm-hmm. that the men would fall into it and experience it.
Don't you believe, though, women can have just as bereft of the feminine?
Absolutely, but she experiences it in a different way because she doesn't separate from it. Men have to separate from their mothers. Women have that continuity where they don't. So they see themselves as the continuity.
Even if they don't have a healthy relationship with their mother?
They're still in a feminine relationship. That's according to Carol Walker-Vyman's work. She's a medical historian.
I don't know. I'm taking this as a archetype. And I don't, in my experience, I don't see any difference in its appearance in men's or women's clothes. It's so repressed in our era. I think everybody's got shortchanged on her. So, who knows?
Well, it just it seemed to me like the Sophia was seemed sort of related to the man's anima, and it didn't really get interpreted that way to a woman.
I wouldn't, she'll be talking about this as the man's anima, but I discourage you from thinking
okay.
personalistically. Whether you see it as the man's anima or the woman's self, I don't think's the point. I think the point is, what does she represent for both of us, and what is she asking of us? Yeah, the man's going to experience it one way, woman's going to experience it another way, maybe. Although I think, you know, we saw the woman fell into it through this dark experience. And I had that dream when going through a dark experience. So I think both sexes get it when they've been clobbered by life somehow. And yeah, and then they're open. By necessity. Then we talked about Sophia historically. That's kind of where we left off. Two follow-ups. I do think about things between these meetings. And somebody challenged or questioned that spider in the DNA dream. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure anymore about what I feel. You might be right. This would be something I'll throw out, a little bit of Jungian methodology. Remember, the dream was that the woman saw a DNA double helix, sort of an hypnagogic vision over her dresser, and then she saw a red spider crawling up. My first thought was that red spider represented the negative mother complex that doesn't want the child to be itself, you know. That's possible, and I kind of justified that by saying that when a person's ego is kind of weak, these negative feminine images are generally destructive because the ego can't stand up against it. So we tend to interpret them personalistically as the negative side of maternal experience. But I'm not so sure about that, so I just open that up. The other thing I considered in retrospect was, you know, that this business of fate, to the extent that we are not ourselves, that we're living a false identity, a false self, our fate, this pattern of our fate, feels threatening. Because we're propped up in a phony way, and it's the real self, and the real self wants to first destroy the phony self before the real self can come in. So it's conceivable that Sophia could be experienced negatively if she's a threat to the false orientation. In that case, the spider could represent Sophia. The spider wouldn't be the destructiveness of something against Sophia, but the threatening aspect of Sophia. How would we figure this out if the dreamer were here? Well, I'd ask her, but she's not here anymore. But it's an interesting methodological question. What I would do if I had infinite time, and if any of you feel like doing some research, be my guest. As far as I know, still, there's no place where Sophia shows up in a negative way. But that may be just my lack of knowledge. I'd be curious if there is such an image of Sophia as a witch. So what we try to do in this work, when we see a possible meaning in a dream, we go to mythology to see, is there any precedent for that? If there's precedent for it, it's more likely that it's what we're thinking of, because it's kind of unlikely that the unconscious is going to come up with a new meaning suddenly after 6,000 years of civilization for an image. Tom?
What about Kali?
Yeah, that's what I was just going
to say. Well, but does Kali represent the pattern of fate?
Yes.
Kali.
Remember in Number and Time where they talked about Kali as the weaver of fate, and they attributed the definition of her name that meant weaving a web, and
I'll
she was
that.
A creator and a destroyer.
That's also creative.
Yeah. Yeah, Carol's saying, and I've forgotten, in the Number and Time, Von Franz does talk about Kali. Kali in India is the destroyer goddess. And Carol reminded me, in Number and Time, Von Franz does talk about Kali as a weaver of fate. So I'll check that. So it could very well be. And in a case like this, where you've got two possible interpretations, you just put it to the dreamer. Here's one way to look at it. Here's another way to look at it. How do you feel? I just wanted to acknowledge that was a very valid point and keep some of these things open for discussion. Another thing we came to, which I thought was interesting, and something else if any of you are art people, I was looking at you, Carol. John asked me about the Van Gogh picture, and somebody said, well, Van Gogh had three different interpretations of that picture. I'd be curious to know what those are. I just don't have the resource to do in a time-efficient way, track it down. If anybody does, please feel free. I did come across one quote, which I would like to read you, which is not about this picture, but it's so relevant to what we're talking about, and why I said I thought Van Gogh really was the herald for the bringing of Sophia to consciousness. This is from his letters, page 394. It's just one sentence, but it says worlds, what this guy could put in a sentence. I want to paint men and women with a touch of the eternal, whose symbol was once the halo, which we try to convey by the very radiance and vibrancy of our coloring. I'll read that again. Won't you paint men and women with a touch of the eternal, whose symbol was once the halo, which we try to convey by the very radiance and vibrancy of our coloring. So see, what Van Gogh is sensing and is articulating is that what once used to be holy is now becoming the intensity of life here and now. That's the breakdown of the projection onto the Christian God, so that the halo doesn't carry the sacred thing anymore. The sacred thing is the intensity with which you live. And of course, he and Nietzsche both tried to do that, and they both burn up. Both went crazy. That's what happens if you do it without Jungian psychology, because Jung found a way to find that intensity without getting burned up by it, by making this distinction between the ego and the self. We could be talking about as we go along. But why this is so relevant to Sophia, what Sophia is, you see, is an attempt to bring the sacred into your life by finding what your story is and living it here and now, so that the sacred task becomes the way you live your life here and now, not based on some religious projection. So I think Van Gogh, what was that, 1888, and Nietzsche about the same time, 1883, we're sensing that the old idea of the holy is breaking down, and there is a new idea of the holy coming, and that holy thing is the emotional power of your daily life and the emotional integrity of your daily life. So it's not that we're giving up the sacred, it's that we're finding the sacred in a new spot. And Sophie is an attempt to make this thing right here the furnace that we cook in.
In effect, he was trying to represent the numinosity of matter with the luminosity of paint.
Of paint, exactly.
So luminosity is numinosity is represented by luminosity.
Right.
And that's basically what I try to do in my paintings also.
Right. Does that make sense to everybody? We talked about the word luminosity, did we not? Yeah. Okay. So just some follow-ups from last time. Then we talked a little bit about the foreword to the book, where she points up that what alchemy was about was the relationship of the unconscious psyche to inorganic matter. As we are talking about it in the Sophia language, how is it that this pattern of your fate is communicated to you by the details of the physical world? Synchronicity, in other words. And that implies that matter, material world, and psyche, the symbolic world, share a common, he calls it a common substrate. And she observes then that this is something that science, the more creative of the physicists, are also examining. How is it that matter is more than just an inert world? And these can leave us in questions, but they're questions of our day, I think. Then we moved on to Sophia. Historically, we talked about Sophia in the Old Testament. Basically, now we're not talking about Jung here. This is strictly Old Testament theology, but it fits so beautifully. Sophia is seen in the Old Testament as the divine plan behind creation. So that's where we left off. And that takes us up to the study guide, page 30. Any questions you want to chew on? All sound familiar? Nobody's getting lost already?
I thought on the comment about Van Gogh, and you mentioned the herald of bringing a Sophia to body consciousness. I've never, ever seen him anywhere him referred to in that aspect. And anything I've ever read about him in a critical view of his work, it's always, well, he's going mad. And I've never...
See the gems you get right here in Indianapolis?
Heard it referred to like that?
It referred to like
that. It sees him in that light of bringing, as a herald of bringing.
Yeah, well, a philosophical lighter.
I've never read about him. And reviews about his life. Personally,
if you read his own writing,
if you read his letters, I mean, you can't think that he was... It was just a beautiful person.
Yeah, if you read his writing, he's very much saying that in other language.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I'm just wondering why I've never seen that brought to light by any of his critics or any art review, any people who love his work.
Well, it's the same reason all the goofy stuff gets on the TV news.
Is everybody else missing this?
Yep.
Yeah, well, I haven't either. I've never seen that aspect. If I just went through his paintings and his world, and things like that.
You probably have a conscious mind.
I think the tragedy of a guy like him was not that he was crazy, but he had these experiences. He had no way to conceptualize them. And that's what drove him mad. And the same with Nietzsche. I think they're exactly the same. They suffered the death of God. I think he says it right above there. Paragraph above that, page 394. I can do well without God. That's the death of God in 1880. I can do well without God in both my life and also in my painting. But suffering as I am, I cannot do without something greater than myself, something which is my life, the power to create. Well, Sophia is that power to create.
Well, didn't you say, too, that the things that he painted were nothing compared to the life lived in the way it should be. Mm-hmm. I remember some passages like that. That was nothing compared to a life.
Now Jung, you see, got Jung's spiritual forebear was Nietzsche. Just because it's a Germanic tradition, I think. And Jung says, if it hadn't been for Nietzsche, I'd have gone crazy. Because the same thing happened to Jung. If you look at those early years of Jung's life, he looks kind of crazy himself. And he was beset with this erotic and libidinous and power intensity, and he didn't know what to do with it. Until he realized, this is from the self. What we do with it is not identify with it, but serve it. That happened when he shot the dream of shooting Siegfried, if those of you are familiar with the biography, which was around 1913 when he split from Freud. So it's...
I'm wondering if the god that Van Gogh rejected was the god of his childhood religion.
Well, it's the god of the halo.
Well, I mean, if, I wonder if he... I don't know enough about his life to know if he was raised in an organized religion.
He would have had to be if he was
French. I would think he
French,
would have
yeah.
been.
He studied for the ministry. He was...
Yeah.
So, I mean...
He worked when he was French,
or
Dutch.
Or Dutch, yeah.
I mean, I rejected the god of my organized religion. And I have a son who's a Baptist, and we were getting in an argument, and he suggested I didn't believe in God, and I said... Well, it depends on your definition of God. I don't believe that there's a little old man with a long white beard sitting on a cloud saying, you've been good, you've been bad. You know, but that's maybe that's what Van Gogh rejected. But maybe
for sure.
Whatever it is that's greater than himself, that was God.
But remember at the time, you see, there was no language to phrase this.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about this and we can say, oh, yes, but there would have been no one nodding to him at that time.
But if you're talking about it, you think you're committing a sin, too.
Exactly.
I mean, now I have permission to talk
right.
like that, but I didn't have permission to talk like that 20 years ago.
No, and imagine 100 years, 120 years
ago. Yeah, I
remember. Okay, so Old Testament, anything else? Tom, did you want to...
Oh, no, I was just shoot off my mouth.
Well, go ahead, shoot.
There's a great movie, Vincent Theo, Robert Altman. And you'd mention something about why you'd gone crazy. And it put forth in that movie that was actually, he would dip his lead paint into his mouth when he painted. So, in a sense, his art is what polluted him. I mean, it led to his madness, the lead poisoning. And then the other thing about Nietzsche, I mean, I thought Goethe was as much of an influence as... And Faust is as much as Nietzsche in the sense of the overcoming.
Yeah.
Because Nietzsche is a definite, in the Germanic tradition of
Europe, right.
it's the same as Goethe.
Right.
It's a continuum. And Goethe is certainly from a Hermetic standpoint. I mean, anyway, that's not sure you want to
know. No? Just what you
said. Well, I was just going to say the other thing they thought was that he was epileptic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was suffering from brain seizures.
Yeah.
And that's how they came to think that there was a section of the brain that was, they called it the God area, that part of the brain was stimulated, you'd have religious visions,
mm-hmm.
and they speculated that that's what his visions were, you know, when he was locked up,
mm-hmm.
they were all religious, and they speculated that part of his brain was seizing.
Was that the pineal gland, then? Is that what they're talking about in their brain?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I don't think so, but I'm not sure.
I don't think they know what the pineal gland is.
Yeah.
Kind of
I don't get
what
is the concept of the god of the halo?
Saintliness and projected worship of a divinity. It's certainly without strong emotion.
Look how that's been stripped out of our culture right now. Strong emotion is you're considered hysterical or something.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine some women have been suggested about them, but you can see that, when you have a scientist on the one hand talking about how it's okay to use chemicals willy-nilly, and parts per million and stuff, it's all fine, who cares about mercury and drinking water and stuff, when you have an environmentalist or something who is really passionate saying this is wrong, we're poisoning people. Well, the culture says that the dispassionate scientist is the one who listens to it.
Yeah, they have a hard game.
Yeah.
So they get emotional and they rip them right out of the scene.
Yeah, it's not allowed for a white
people.
You know,
they're
not allowed
to. He's still emotional. Too emotional to be president. That was the end of his presidential career.
And then look at the guy who is president who seems stripped of any emotion.
Yeah.
Compassion. Yeah.
Well, you can see how relevant this material is.
Very.
And I get told all the time, oh, you're so lucky you didn't have girls. They're so hard to raise. They're so emotional. I'm so tired of people saying that. That girls are so emotional and boys are so easy to raise.
A little cheaper, maybe.
I have three boys. I'm thinking I got all easy when I've seen someone go through with their girls.
But see, I don't think we should talk that way.
No, I don't.
Mm-hmm. Because the girls are trying to accommodate to a myth that doesn't fit them. I mean, jeez.
Yeah.
It's that riles me up terribly.
That's another whole session class.
It is. It's hard being a girl. It's hard being a boy, but it's hard being a girl.
It's hard being.
Gnosticism, page 30. What we're doing now is we're following a historical history, a historical account of Sophia. We went, sorry, with the Old Testament. A study guide, page 30. The next real place that Sophia surfaced was in Gnosticism. Let's talk a little bit about Gnosticism. Does everyone know what Gnosticism is? Everybody. Okay, you're sure about that?
I have.
Wasn't there a lot of different theories in the, among them?
Okay. Around the birth of Christ, there were many different interpretations of what happened. Eventually, one interpretation became dogma, and the other interpretations were deemed heresies. As Mary said, there were many different sects, and a label to describe a group of those sects, to define the theological bases common to those sects, is Gnosticism. It comes from the Greek word gnosis. And the basic idea in Gnosticism is that when God created, and again, there are many different versions of this, but the basic common denominator, when God created the world, part of God fell into the world and got trapped there. Sometimes that was a trick. Sometimes a lesser God created the world and took part of the bigger God and trapped it in the world. There are all sorts of varieties of it. But the bottom line is that pieces of God are trapped in everything in the world. And the job of the religious person is to know the peace of God in them. And often this can't be done alone. Christ, then, is thought to be a helper here, to help you know the divine in yourself. So that when you die, the peace of God trapped in you goes back to God. So you can see the established church couldn't stomach this for a couple of reasons. One, there's no room for the church in this. Who needs a church? So they couldn't stand that. The other heretical viewpoint is that it is not human beings that need redemption. It's God that needs redemption. So God is in constant need of recovering part of himself or herself. Now, one of the attributes of God in some accounts that gets caught in the world is Sophia. So sometimes it's God trapped in the world. Sometimes it's Sophia trapped in the world. And they talk about Sophia pretty much the way we've been talking about it. So they're taking that Old Testament idea, and they're just advancing it a step. So that wisdom is an aspect of God in some accounts that gets trapped in the world. Well, you can see why you don't like this so much. Because this is just what we're talking about, that there isn't this separation between matter and spirit. And when we say that a synchronicity is an event in the physical world that communicates to you your sacred story, another way of saying that is that Sophia trapped in matter. The wisdom of your life can be communicated to you through material events. If you abstract that a little bit, and put it in terms of Jung's theoretical understanding of personality, that's to say that the unconscious is not separate from matter. We are wrong to think that the unconscious is only something inside us. There's also part of the psyche outside of us. And that's all we know. But you can see how Sophia was so important in preserving this this truth that we're trying to understand, that the sacred and the material are two separate things. In the Orthodox understanding, they are two separate things, but not in the Gnostic understanding. So that's basically the page 30.
So the dualism where the dark and light are separated in Gnosticism?
It's still dualistic.
Where does that come in relation to Sophia? Is she like something that agrees with Jung's ideas within Gnosticism, but yet Gnosticism as a whole is still dualistic and doesn't agree overall?
Well, it's still dualistic in that, you see, the Sophia trapped in matter, that's kind of a neutral fact. But there are bad things trying to keep that there.
How closely tied is Sophia with Lucifer?
Hang on to that. There's a link.
I had never thought about it before, but the other day I read something, I came across the meaning of Lucifer. The etymology is the bringer of light.
Right.
And he's also the bright morning star.
Right.
So, yeah, it's like I had the same way life as you.
Yeah, I'll get to that. Yeah, there is. I don't think there's a connection historically, but there is psychologically. Yeah. So what was I saying?
Talking about how...
Oh, the dualism of Gnosticism, that there are bad things fighting your enterprise to live a life that will bring the divine spark in you back. And so you're seeking, often you'll be seeking Jesus Christ against the devil, because Jesus Christ is the force that will help you live correctly so that your spark can go back to God.
So the dark and the light aren't brought together.
They're not brought together. And in a way, they still do make this distinction between matter and spirit. But it's at least a step forward from the Christian split. And the Gnostics were very often very, very prudish people. They lived this ascetic life. They saw the way to fighting the evil and to being pure, so that this piece of God in you stayed pure, was through a very rigorous and ascetic lifestyle. So practically speaking, they're about as bad as the Christians.
Because they're trying to get away from darkness.
Right. But still, you can see, if you look at it historically, that their point of view, at least in a symbolic way, carries the compensatory portrayal of the relationship between spirit and matter that you've got in Christianity.
And Christianity, too, is even divided up, because you have, I'm Christian, but I am not, the fundamental Christian, which is a very, it's definitely the New Age, the Catholic Christ, different things, coming in,
Yeah, I probably should say medieval Christianity.
Right. Well, it still exists today, the medieval Christianity.
Yeah, fundamentalism.
My understanding is that Augustine was Manichaean. And he actually was a Manichaean until he was 29.
I think you're right.
And so what happened then is when he began to develop his orthodoxy, it came right out of the Gnostic tradition by
right
the split.
Right.
And that created a further embedment into Christianity. What he did, though, is then he split God out completely. Not within, but outside.
Yeah.
And the other part of it is the Gnostics were very ascetic. Augustine also took on that piece and said that we need to be able to control our body. Mm-hmm. So that's where that thinking began to develop,
yeah,
and that led to eventually to original sin,
mm-hmm,
that we are born sinful by
mm-hmm
nature.
Mm-hmm.
But it came straight through that Manichaean mm-hmm tradition right into the Christian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But didn't take along the bright side of it, which was the I know,
mm-hmm,
the God spark within.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get that out.
Would the God spark they talk about in Gnosticism be equal to the self in the Jung?
Yes.
Okay.
What was the question?
Is the God spark equivalent to the self? Yes. We can talk more about that. Yeah, I don't want to get us too. Yeah, I don't want to get us too far off track. But there's a lot more to say there. I'm just trying to get you a very basic sense of not a Sophia theoretically in examples and now historically how she has appeared apart from Jung.
Mm-hmm.
So you okay with that? They're the two basic biblical sources. Well, not biblical. Judeo-Christian, I guess I could say, sources. Edinger gives us a nice summary of wisdom on page 31. 31. It's kind of, he's just summing up now what we've been doing historically. So you've got it all in one place if you like to have things organized for yourself. He observes that the first appearance of Sophia is Greek. And that's, Sophia is the root word of philosophy, philosophia. So the Greeks would see their inquiry into philosophical questioning as in the service of Sophia, love of Sophia. And then comes Proverbs. Remember we talked about that. The quote which is given to you on page 31 we've already read. We read that on page 27. I just put it there again so you have it all in place. So the Greeks, the Hebrews, some other books that we'll be looking at, Song of Songs. She appears. You don't have to worry about that. We'll spend time on that. That's in the official canon. There are some apocryphal books where she appears. I don't think we need to spend any time on them, except I would like to read you on page 32 from Ecclesiasticus, which is apocryphal. Sophia's... some of Sophia's characteristics. Page 32. Go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Go 10 lines down. She walks. Just to hear a little bit of now the biblical description of her and see how close it is to how we're understanding her. She walks with him as a stranger. And at first, she puts him to the test. Fear and dread she brings upon him.
The web.
The web?
Fear and dread she brings upon him.
What did I say?
No, I mean that indicates the web.
Oh, yes. I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. You see where we are? Page 32?
Yeah.
I'll start over. She walks with him as a stranger, and at first she puts him to the test. Fear and dread she brings upon him and tries him with her discipline. It's funny you would think of discipline in Sophia, but it's very much an issue of discipline. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of discipline. With her precepts, she puts him to the proof until his heart is fully with her. Then she comes back to bring him happiness and reveal her secrets to him. That's a beautiful passage, I think.
So if you're going to walk with her, you got to straighten up and fly right.
I don't know about fly right.
You got to fly forward.
Got to fly something.
Well, I don't think it's the bar doing. I believe it's...
Well, I just think the discipline stuff, you know.
But even so, I believe that when she puts that hand on it, it's not something that is struggle. I believe that she also gives you the... strength to obey it. You know, I mean, it's interesting. You know, yeah. There's, I think, when that finger's put on, it's not something you have to really strive about or try to ego-wise, try to get rid of and get your life together. I think it comes naturally when you're working on the inner, and it comes out. To me,
but there's pain.
What does
the discipline
do then?
Finding the pattern.
But the, you know, I can't remember the exact etymology of the word discipline, but it's not punitive. It's more of a kind of a learning mm-hmm. and bringing along beside, like mm-hmm. disciples. Mm-hmm. It's not like punishment.
I see discipline, following the rules. Yeah, I see discipline at my age, over 50 barely. It pulls you together to be free to choose. Whereas before, when one is scattered, you know, it's free to choose.
Did she? Another legend, which is a Gnostic legend, refers to a figure named Simon Magus. Simon Magus appears in the Old, in the New Testament in just one brief reference, but he's taken on a kind of legendary significance, that he finds Sophia as a prostitute in a brothel in Tyre. And she is a combination of Helen of Troy and Sophia. So that bridges the two traditions. You look puzzled.
Well, no, that's what I was kind of lost 2 weeks from or last time we were talking. I had the different, I've kind of been experiencing the feminine through, I have had the experience with Mary Magdalene and the shark energy and the mad woman and all these different things, the mother. And I was thinking those are all aspects, but now you're saying that is part of Sophia also. So is Sophia the whole? That's what initially that's what I thought, and then I thought, well, no, it's just the healing aspect. Remember we talked about that?
Yeah. Well, remember in the unconscious, everything is everything.
Right.
But to give our mind something to hold on to,
right.
I would say Sophia is the a priori pattern of your identity.
Okay, nice.
Sophia is that inborn story that you were given to live. That's be how I would put it in a phrase, knowing that I'm limiting it as much as defining it, but we do need something to hold on to.
Right. So she remains a mystery.
Well, she does remain a mystery until she starts showing you the plan, and then living of that plan is experiencing the mystery here in time and space. Yeah.
Just as God can be in the message, I would think Sophia can, and she's there too.
Yeah.
So what? I'm sorry.
If God can be in the messes, you know, where we stumble, there a treasure lies, kind of idea.
Oh.
That's
yeah, the other corollary is that this pattern is generally made known to you through difficult experiences.
Right.
Often.
But the whole, though.
Pardon me?
We're experiencing God, that if she is God, that's the whole. I mean, God.
Right,
she is
don't
God.
Separate the two.
Yeah.
She is.
Right. She's a feminine aspect of God.
It's not that she's a separate.
Right. Although they do kind of, as they say, hypostasize her. They make her into her own being.
Right.
But it's you could say the feminine form, the mysterious might be another way to put it.
Right. See, I had an experience like several, 12 years ago where I had the white buffalo woman that I talked about and Jesus Christ. And actually experienced the two merging together, becoming one. It was a real profound experience. Not Jesus the man, but the cosmic Christ, you know, that mm-hmm. energy. You know, that. It was real interesting. But that male, female coming together, that kind of thing. So it's.
Sounds similar.
Mm-hmm.
The things to lift out of this legend, this Gnostic legend, is how Sophia is the despised. So she's a prostitute, the despised. It might be more accurate to say she is found in despised experiences. Remember the woman's affair. I think that's classy. And in the legend, she's an amalgam of Helen of Troy and Sophia. Remember, Helen of Troy was the one they fought the battle, the Trojan War over. And it all started because she was a libidinous female. So the other aspect then of Sophia is that these difficult experiences are often of a sexual nature. Sophia is found in the complications that emerge if you follow your libido seriously.
Though, in the
Jungian
sense of the creative
energy. No, in the Freudian sense.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Which is?
Sex.
Hey.
Sex and power. I mean, again, I'm trying to put a a circular concept in a square box. But our mind doesn't register circles. Our mind registers lines. So that's why I'm trying to make this coherent. Sophia, it would basically be found in those difficult experiences, those experiences which seem despicable. Oh, if I hadn't done that kind of experiences, why did I do that kind of experiences? And those experiences are often characterized by the instincts of sexuality and power. So again, the irony is that the most spiritual, your story, is made known to you through the most concrete instinctual experiences of your life. And we'll be looking at that. If you know how to work with them. You can go blindly from experience to experience. Remember in that dream, she could do it once, but she couldn't do it twice. And I think a lot of promiscuity is not getting the Sophia message out of the experience. And so the person thinks they're after the physical pleasure of sex or the rush of power, but they're really after Sophia. And they're always disappointed when they get the sexual object or they get the object of power. Because it's not, Sophia is just using sex and power as her language. So Philosophia, Chochmah, that's the Old Testament. Sophia, that's Gnosticism. And then in 500-600 years later, she becomes Sapientia Dei. And that's the medieval philosophy. That's page 32, first, second, third paragraph. So she becomes an object of medieval thought. Of medieval theology. And there she becomes the forms in the mind of God by which God created the world. Through which God created the world. Well, of course, it's completely sanitized. But you can see the truth in that. That Sophia is the form of your life by which you are to create yourself. Or through which the greater power in your life is trying to get you to be yourself. So forms in the mind of God, the way Vanderpump has put it, is the inborn story. Form and story, two different ways of describing, from totally different traditions, the same experience. But hopefully you can see that we're trying to grasp an experience here, and we're looking at it from many different traditions, and each tradition expressed a part of it. And what Jung has tried to do is respect all of those traditions to get an understanding of what she is psychologically. That they each had a piece of her accurately described.
Is anything related to the Aristotelian idea form?
You have to tell me about that.
It seems to me that it is, but that's what you're saying, that you start with the form and you end with what its meaning is.
I think you're right. The only difference might be that, and here I'm at the edge of my knowledge, but I think what Thomas did was go to these ideas and then theologize them. Mm-hmm. So that form becomes the form that God used to create the world.
Right.
So he takes up a notch.
Right.
Yeah. I think the basic idea is the same, although taken on a higher level.
To me, my understanding is it's just all archetypal.
Archetypal, yeah.
So as you come through Plato, and it's all the same thing. It's just being
restated.
Shaped in different ways depending on your consciousness at the time.
Yeah.
Which to me makes it so exciting.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you're getting a sense. That's why I'm doing this laborious beginning. So you realize we're not just talking in the air here. This experience has had a 2,500 year history. And this is not something Jung just made up. This is a fundamental part of our experience, which has been disregarded. And he's just trying to show us how to recover that experience, and then how other traditions described it. But this is not just something he's made up.
Gary, can I take this one step further. Just,
yeah.
You know, Tarnas in his book talks about the fact that the masculine separated first out of the creative matrix,
mm-hmm.
and became the norm, and the feminine became the deviant.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the feminine had to hold her shape in a concealed fashion, which needed to happen so that you could separate that subject and object. So as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, this is where she concealed herself.
One of the places.
Right. This is mm-hmm. one of the places, I mean, as you're talking, I'm hearing that more and more, is that, mm-hmm. that she concealed herself mm-hmm. behind the revealed masculine, because
mm-hmm.
that masculine needed to get, the more he got revealed, the more then we could begin to see her.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
So then she takes on this shape, but no shape.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're trying to give her a shape again.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which I think is, mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it's just exciting.
Mm-hmm.
To begin to see it in all of these places.
Mm-hmm. And then see it in your own individual experience.
Right.
And realize how hard it is to deal with.
I held on for a long time.
And you see why. I saw what that poor woman went through who had the affair. I mean, it almost killed her. She got a new life out of it, and her dream supported it, but it almost killed her. She was a laughingstock of many people who then found out about it. She was an adulteress. You know, Central Indiana, you might as well hang it up.
Well, it must have been a long time.
Yeah. Do you want to share something with us?
Oh, I have to re-sanitize it.
Then finally, bottom of 32, comes Sapientia in alchemy. And alchemy, she is that spirit of God trapped in, page 32, bottom, study guide. She is that spirit in matter trapped in the material world that the alchemists are trying to free up. And when they free it up, the material becomes gold. I will just put a little plug in for the book. She was the feminine personification of prima materia, seeking rescue by the alchemists. That's another version of Sophia, caught in the dark embrace of matter, requiring rescue. That all sounds familiar by now, I hope. The outstanding alchemical example of Sophia or Sapientia Dei text is the Aurora Consurgent, which Marie-Louise von Franz edited, and to which she contributed a commentary. I consider Aurora Consurgent von Franz's finest work. So that's what we're doing here. And the first paragraph is what we, last paragraph is what we will be looking at in the book anyway, so. That's a summary of theoretical, dream examples, and historical for Sophia. Are you happy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can look at Sophia. Carol has painted a couple of pictures. The first one, I think you had no idea, Sophia, did you? You just did the first painting totally spontaneously, no?
Inspired by this poem.
Oh, go ahead. So Carol wants... No, you read it.
Can you read it?
So just tell them a little bit about how that painting came to be.
Okay, I used to take part in something called the Humpback Festival, which is a festival where painters are paired with poets. And you go, at that time, you would choose a painting and then respond to it, or choose a poem and respond to it with a painting. And here's the poem I chose. It's called The Midnight Jeweler, written by Sharon Henriksen. It goes, "The night lies at my feet. A slumbering jewel sparks dim to rest to reclaim identity. The gem stirs in its sleep. Internal flames collide. Come back to me, I say, addressing the energies collected in youth, left scattered, invested in unfinished projects, draped now in plastic like crouching ghosts. Perhaps they too sleep, unpolished, rough cut, dreaming of brilliancy."
Wait, do I hear it again? Let's read it again.
"The night lies at my feet, a slumbering jewel, sparks dim to rest, to reclaim identity. The gem stirs in its sleep, internal flames collide. Come back to me, I say, addressing the energies collected in youth, left scattered, invested in unfinished projects, draped now in plastic like crouching ghosts.
Perhaps they too sleep, unpolished, rough cut, dreaming of brilliancy. To me, that really speaks of what we've been saying, the pattern, finding the pattern. You know, perhaps she's had glimpses of it, energies that she's scattered in youth into unfinished projects. And she sees them as, well, you know, the uncut gem seems to me to refer to that idea of the spark in matter, you know, laying there rough cut. And to find it, I suppose, would be to polish it, to finish it. So,
to ask it to come back.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
To find the pattern.
You have to invite it back.
So, which one does it do? So the painting is
this one. Now, where put this?
You want to hold this for you?
Yeah, I'll do.
And first, I should tell you what you're looking at. I'm sure you can tell that the figure's pregnant. And she seems to me to be sitting, you know, in a bathtub almost, and as though this is the water, and yet also it's the night sky. And she's waxing, which, if anyone was grown up on a farm, you know, waxing is what happens to the animal before it gives birth. Some of the milk comes out. That's waxing. And as she waxes, the droplet turns into the uncut gem. That's, you'd have to get close. But this last drop is an uncut gem. And it drops into creation, so to speak, you know. And this galaxy, you can see the center of it is a splash, so the visual idea of the galaxy and water come together there. But
also, the colors you use, the red, kind of the reddish tone, red and yellow, those are indicative of tissue also, part of it.
And she's dark, you know. Mm-hmm. She and we, I guess we get to the idea of the Shulamite later, mm-hmm. but you know, she's not. She's an earthen sort of.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the color on the other breast and the belly, which looks like there is light, perhaps some light from fire. Mm-hmm.
You know, somewhere the book talked about. About a sort of light
coming up
that was above the waters, and I'm trying to remember. Let's see if I were. Well, yeah, it's marked in the book, and when we get there, I'll show you where in the book that I think it talks about that, but. So then Jung says that the diamond would be a symbol of individuation, and also it's that spark that falls it into matter. And we talked about Simon Magus just a moment ago, and he was an alchemist, is that right? Or a Gnostic.
Gnostic, yeah.
A Gnostic, okay. And he says that the procreative urge is of a fiery origin. And he says that fire is related to blood, which is fashioned warm and ruddy like fire. Blood turns into semen in men and into milk in women. And so that connects the idea of the milk, you know, and her being co-creator with God, or God's master workman. And the idea is that she realizes God's thoughts by clothing them in material form. So her creative essence is giving materiality to her to to God's creation. And here's another Gnostic myth that I read that seemed to talk about the painting. It says that the first chaotic matter was watered by the streams of heaven and adorned by God with numberless ideas of the species. The Spirit of God descended into matter, and this is what happened to him there. The Spirit of God fertilized the upper waters with a peculiar fostering warmth and made them, as it were, milky. The fostering warmth of the Holy Spirit brought about, therefore, in the waters that are above the heavens, a virtue subtly penetrating and nourishing all things. The supercelestial spirit of the waters, united in marriage with light, may justly be called the soul of the world. And Jung says this is the noose descending from the higher spheres. But there was an, you know, maybe you guys have heard of the Nag Hammadi text, the Gnostic text that they found. Well, quite a while after I created this, I read something in those texts that really struck me as describing the painting. And this part of the text is Jesus talking about where the soul comes from. And he says that, "I have awakened that drop from Sophia that it might bear much fruit through me." And also they say, "From the eons above the emanations of light, a drop from the light and spirit came down to the lower regions of Almighty and chaos, that their molded forms might appear from that drop." And until I read those parts of the Nag Hammadi, I really didn't understand the symbolism of the drop. But there it was. But of course, you know, when I create these paintings, I don't really get into what they're about. You know, only later do I find out.
Yeah, I don't think you knew about Sophia at all when you painted this, did you?
Which proves
I knew
the plan is within you.
Right. That's mm-hmm. that's Sophia acting, you know, in that. But no, I mean, you know, I had heard of Sophia, but I didn't know what
you
she symbolized.
Say, I wanted to illustrate Sophia. You just sort of painted it for
No.
Express what was inside you.
That's right. So. I did it, you know, expressly to express that poem.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That poem.
Really, this sums up really that one chapter we talked about in here about the colors in the painting. Where it says the four alchemical stages, the golden hour of dawn shines yellow and red, and midday between night and day. And it almost looks like, it, you know what I mean, with mm-hmm. night and day. That's beautiful. You know, it's a touch of
color.
It's almost
like a sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah, I found a lot of places in the text where I think it's talking about it.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Do you want to stretch and then we'll come back?